Welcome to episode 8 of Binging Bridgerton, a podcast going episode by episode through the new Shondaland Netflix series adapting the Bridgerton historical romance novels by Julia Quinn. With me today are co-host Amrita. Good morning, Amrita.
Good morning, Beth.
And we also have our friend Uday on to talk about this with us, even though, in his own words, not only is this not up his alley, he's never even been on this alley before. Thank you, Uday, for coming back for another episode.
Thanks, Beth.
We did it. We're in episode 8, the last episode of this series. Everything happens, everything resolves, everything is restored, mostly. Let's talk about some of the topsy-turvy and how it shakes out. I would like to start with Marina, actually, because I just find myself drawn to Marina over and over again. And we find out in this episode that not only her attempt to mix up some kind of weird potion to give herself an abortion did not work. I don't know about you, but I didn't think that was going to work, frankly. And the doctor, the doctor in his hilarious wig is very derisive of her attempts at some science. I have to say, I was pleased that the Featheringtons did actually bring in a doctor, because for a second I thought maybe they're just going to let her suffer, but they didn't. So we find out not only did that not work, but also her past lover, he's dead. His brother comes into town and tells them that the reason he hadn't been responding to her letters is because he was dead. Uday, did that take you by surprise when it happened?
A bit. I mean, there's just so much happening with Marina in the last moments of the actually not even in the last moments, through this the last episode and then this one, the previous episode and this, where there's just like so much story that goes. So it was a little like I'd barely recovered from her devotion tea, as you put it, and now this whole thing is happening. frankly, it happened really fast for me to even sort of react to it in an emotional way.
Yeah,
her put down in very typical Marina fashion is immediate, and there isn't a doubt in her mind. The brother of her dead lover proposes that he will sort of take her as his wife and accept their child. And she's just like, no way. I liked his brother. Who is this guy?
Yeah.
It's very Home Up Gay Hancock, right? Siblings swooping in.
Do you remember, like, is it Kiki Palmer who had that thing where they showed her a photo of, I think, who was it? Like somebody famous. I think maybe Dick Cheney or somebody. And she was like, who is this man? I do not know this man. Good luck to this man. And I just thought of that the whole time, because Lady Featherington is obviously really for the marriage, because this is an excellent way to rehabilitate not just Marina, but also the Featheringtons in society, you know, just to get them married.
And she's totally right. And it's odd to find yourself agreeing with Lady Featherington wholeheartedly, but she's absolutely right. And not just in a calculating way, but in a full-on reality sort of way.
Yeah. I really like Lady Featherington in this episode because, you know, she's still the person that she is all throughout the series. But you kind of get where she's coming from, you know, especially in that little conversation that she has with Marina before Marina leaves, where, you know, she just says, you know, like, you're doing better than me because at least you know what, you know, you have like the sense of like what you want, and, you know, life is probably going to be kinder to you in many ways. But she is a woman who's had to learn a few hard things about life. And you kind of see, like, all throughout the series, we've had this this distinction or this comparison between the Featheringtons and the Bridgertons. But it really does come down to the difference between Lady Featherington and Violet Bridgerton. Because they've had such different experiences of life and love and marriage. And you see that that is their biggest difference, and that is what has gone on to inform the lives of their children as well. So yeah, there's like a ton of things. Like, as Uday says, there's like 5 million plot points being thrown into this last episode.
So Daphne and Simon are throwing a ball. And that's going to be the last ball of the season, and it's also probably going to be the end of their marriage, depending on how they have no plans to stay together. And even though Daphne then is a lot more positively disposed towards Simon because of something that happens, she finds his letters to his dad, which is interesting because it changes the tone of the episode completely. Beth, were you counting on that? Did you think that was how things were going to get fixed?
No, I didn't. And maybe I should have, given that we know so much about the letters from an earlier episode in the flashbacks when he's a little kid. But you shouldn't snoop on your partner. We all know that. Like, don't take their phone. But also, since he won't talk to you, I absolutely think that this is an emotionally valid, if not logically valid, thing to do. And also because a lot of the information does actually come from Lady Danbury. So it's not just Daphne figuring it out on her own. She does need to be told. Daphne always needs to be told. But she's also 18 or whatever, so maybe that's quite realistic. But I was very moved by this whole turn of events and how Daphne takes what she has experienced, what she's read, what Lady Danbury tells her, and what her mother tells her about, you know, finally getting some good advice. Like, you have to choose every day to love the person you're with and try to work through things together and move forward together. Like, that's still very good advice. And she actually is able to synthesize those things into something that is kind to Simon, who is a person who desperately needs some kindness.
Yeah. And also, you know, just to be a little bit more shallow, was anybody else surprised that the big Simon and Daphne ball was actually held outdoors?
I hadn't thought about it, but it certainly allowed for some beautiful aerial shots of the checkerboard floor that I saw online. Someone point out mirrors the checkerboard floor in his country house. So you have a nice parallel moments, but it sure was beautiful and allows for dramatic rain.
Because it's London in spring. Like, what kind of idiot holds a ball outside in London in spring?
Yeah. I mean, Vauxhall is outside, right? Most of the scenes there are outside. That doesn't seem to be a problem.
Well, but Vauxhall has like a different
purpose,
because in Regency romance and probably in history, I don't know, but Vauxhall is actually a place where people go, and there are like these gazebos and stuff where you can stay in out of the weather.
Right.
But also the reason why it's outside is because you have these, like the walk, you know, like the, you know how like Burbrook assaults Daphne or tries to assault Daphne and gets decked in the face? So those are called walks, and basically people go on these little walks because there's no lights. And you can hide in the shrubbery and possibly make out or even have sex. So it's, you know, the British have this long tradition of like outdoor sex at all levels of society. And basically that's what Vauxhall is about. So
I mean, the Queen's lunch is also outside. So the ball is not, this ball is not the only uncovered event. But yeah, no, it doesn't seem like if you had an option to put it somewhere else, you probably should have. But it seems like seems like Simon's townhouse doesn't have a ballroom.
Yeah.
How dare he?
but then again, isn't the rain like a rain at the end of like a Regency romance? Isn't that a big thing? I feel like I've seen a couple of films in which that happens. So I was wondering whether that was a beat which they felt that they would like to hit also.
I feel like maybe you're thinking about like Pride and Prejudice from 2005.
I am. I think I sort of somehow put Little Women also into it, which also has like that big scene in the rain. So I'm obviously new to this genre.
No, it's lovely. I mean, we've talked before, like Beth and I have talked before about like how this film is, I mean, the series is actually also very much in context of the kind of movies that we are used to in this era. And part of that is like British romance that we've seen in the past like 20, 30 years. So yeah. It's movies from the 90s, movies from the early 2000s, everything from like, you know, Hugh Grant romances to things like Pride and Prejudice. So you're not off base about it. Yeah. That's probably where they're getting their inspirations from.
And there's a very important pivot in The Rain, which is Daphne being washed away of all of her pretenses and saying, I just love you and I'm going to try to do what it takes to stay with you and make this work together. And it's, you know, that couldn't have been a scene in the sunshine, I think, and worked the right. same way. And it makes her seem, you know, more down to earth, like actually connecting her to the earth through the water falling and, you know, all that. And it's a rebirth and all that kind of stuff. So I think it was very effective, if illogical, from a planning perspective.
I yeah. thought you were going to say that it washed her off her sins. Like, well, that too.
I don't think the series ever got around to thinking of it as a sin for her. Like,
agreed.
I don't think she ever saw it that way either.
But I do think she realizes that she has wounded him, right? And I sure. don't think she apologizes, but I think she has finally, especially through the words of the elder women, you know, understood what she did. She has that good language about any imperfect things. Imperfect people still deserve love and, you know, none of us are perfect and blah, 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 which is also kind of ties to water and you know, the ball doesn't go perfectly and neither will their marriage and neither are they as humans, but it's all right.
Talking about imperfect people, let's talk about Lord Featherington, who is, I mean, it's a cruel trick, but he gets the most airtime in this episode, and it's the episode in which he gets murdered. But he convinces Will to throw the match, and then Will and Simon have this wonderful scene where Simon is like, well, where's your honor? And Will is like, it doesn't feed my kids. And again, like, you know, this is like we've talked about the education of all the different characters in this series. And this is Simon's education, which he has to have every couple of episodes, I feel, because this is something that he has had with Will, with his wife, with like various people about like how he's really privileged and he doesn't really understand. But after Will and Featherington do their little plan, Featherington makes off with like tons of money and Will is now set for life. And then while the Featheringtons are at the ball with Simon and Daphne and the rest of the Ton, and they're dreaming of a life that has now gone back to normal, Lord Featherington goes to a brothel where he is met with some of his cronies who also want his money. Uday, I didn't quite understand the logistics of that thing, and I was hoping like maybe you could help me out. Like, what do you think like happened? Like, did he bring them back to the house and take the money, or did he take all the money and then go to the brothel? Like, what was that?
Yeah, I was a little confused myself. I'm guessing he had at least some of the money when he went to the brothel. And he had, I don't know, he promised them the deed to his house earlier, before the fight, that, you know, if he didn't come good. And I wonder if that is somehow going to come back into play now that he's dead in a later season.
I hope so, because I was very invested in the Featheringtons by the end of this, and I would like to see what happens, especially because Lady Featherington says, oh no, about who's going to inherit, and we have no idea
yeah,
who it is.
I feel that, I hope it's something, you know, connected to those, because otherwise it's, those two cronies of his, that was a little confusing, because they just keep giving him these meaningful looks, and they're obviously, like, tough guys, and too smart for Lord Featherington. I'm not exactly sure what happened there. But I did enjoy the atmosphere at the boxing match. The fight itself was a little it was less than convincing, as in there are enough movies in which a fighter has to throw about, you know, and it can be done a lot better than this. This was just like it. This was so fake that, like, I think any kind of deception, successful deception on Lord Featherington's part, just went after Will. Just really made it obvious that he was throwing the game.
I wonder if that also contributed to his murder. Like, they knew that he did them dirty.
Yeah, maybe.
But of course, we are going to see the Featheringtons going forward because, well, there's that unresolved plot point between poor Pen and Colin. You know, like, Pen is just about to gather her courage and confess her feelings to Colin when Colin, being the idiot Bridgerton he is, announces that he's leaving for Greece. Also, there's the big reveal, which was a huge surprise to me as somebody who's read the series, because the reveal in the book doesn't actually come until the fourth book or so. But yeah, it isn't until Penelope has her own story that we learn that Penelope Featherington is Lady Whistledown.
I 100% did not see that coming, but many people I've talked to said they thought it was obvious.
I didn't see it coming either. Maybe I need to go back and sort of see the Whistledown and Penelope scenes and if it makes sense. But right now, to me, it seemed like a nice shock reveal, but doesn't quite sit right with me at the moment.
I think the reveal of Marina's pregnancy is the one thing that really cuts down on the number of people it could possibly have been. Is that right, Amrita?
Yes. But also, there's a scene where Queen Charlotte has her her afternoon party, and then the Featheringtons are asked to leave. And then in the next Whistledown sheet, there is no mention of what happened at the party, as if Lady Whistledown was ignoring it. And the Queen thinks that she's been slighted, but actually, it's because Penelope wasn't there and she didn't know what happened at the party. The way that they're setting this up, it's really interesting to me, you know, just looking at the way that it's been adapted from the books, because we don't see any of this in the books, you know, because we don't get to the reveal until much later. But the way that it's being set up is that Penelope is at once smarter than everybody else around her, but particularly Eloise, who is still sort of trying to find who Lady Whistledown is and just failing miserably. But also, this is giving Penelope, you know, like with what happens to Marina later on, which I don't know, like if you want spoilers, but given what happens to Marina later on and given her own part in the public humiliation of her family and then, you know, what happens with her dad and everything, it really gives Penelope an idea of her culpability in the misery of others.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she is definitely much more mature at this point than Eloise. I think that that is a trajectory that will only deepen as the series goes on and as Lady Whistledown has all this power. But Penelope in her real life is probably one of the least empowered people, because, you know, in her family, she's the, you know, the ugly duckling, even though it's Nicola Coughlan, who is delightful. And I don't know what that means, but, you know, that's the dichotomy of the Penelope character.
It's pretty great to have a young woman get to be the person with all of this perspective and a voice, even though it's a voice she has to hide under another identity. But I feel like that's not perhaps particularly common, especially at the sort of broadcast level that Lady Whistledown has. Like, we're used to Elizabeth Bennet being smart about her own family, but you know, to be the commentator of all of society is it's pretty great. I was very, very pleased by this reveal.
So Colin's gonna go off to Europe because why not? There's not much for him to do. Nothing much for him to do out here. Antony and Sienna, surprise, surprise, does not work out. because he turns up at her door at night, and she's with a rich duke or something. Someone of Antony's class, anyways. And she basically was supposed to accompany him, and she does not at the last moment when he goes looking for her. She basically cuts it off and tells him that he has to stop following her. And apparently he is going to stop following her, because he tells his family that he's going to marry.
And Amrita, you shared a note with us about this that says, which is good because his girl just showed up in town, and I hadn't caught that whatsoever. So I'm very curious who Anthony's love interest is going to be, and I have a guess based on the flitting around of the little bee, but I don't know that I'm right, and I shouldn't be spoilery probably. So
Anthony's love interest is one of the best in the series, so I've got my fingers crossed for her. But the whole thing with Sienna is really interesting, because they're back in bed with each other, and then what Anthony does, like, you know, inviting her to go to the ball with him, to me as a Regency reader, like, that was, like, really shocking, because A, he's going to be taking his mistress to meet the women in his family, which is a giant no-no. But also, you know, he's trying to change the terms of their relationship in a way that, you know, like, what does that mean, like, if he takes her to the ball? Because in the Regency period, things like that, you know, they have meaning. Like, you don't just do that on a whim. So is he going to declare his, you know, his honorable intentions? Like, does he intend to marry her? Like, is that what it is? Because I can't imagine that Violet Bridgerton would be, like, too happy to you know, have an opera singer for a daughter-in-law. But also, like, I think that Sienna's speech to him, where she's just like, you've got to let me go, and you've got to let me, like, look out for myself, because I'm the only one that will. Like, that's totally on point, because Anthony is, like, super confused. Like, he starts the series really confused, and he ends the series really confused. So she's absolutely right in that sense. But I didn't quite understand her point about, like, being with the other guy because he won't try to change her. Because I'm like, I don't get it. Like, what is Anthony trying to change about you, other than, you know, maybe take you out of the shadows of his life and, like, give you a more prominent place in society? But I don't, like, she makes it sound like he's the worst person in the world for making her put on a ball gown and go to a ball. And I'm like, of all the things that Anthony has done to you, yeah, and all the things that Anthony's done wrong, like, that is the least of it, and I don't understand it.
She has, I forget if it's maybe the previous episode, he says, "What, I'm a Viscount, my sister's a Duchess, no one will say anything," and she says, "Not to you."
Right.
And I think that's what it's about, is that he can withstand the sniggering of society for a season, and she cannot, because she is not these people's peer, and she never will be. Although, as one of, I think it was Manish who pointed out, like, Anthony, so the king could elevate an entire race of people by a marriage, but Anthony can't elevate one opera singer by a marriage. It doesn't quite line up with what this show has tried to suggest about love conquering all with major societal injustices. But I think that's what she's thinking, is that, like, well, easy for you to say, because you're not the one who's going to have to step outside what they've always been told they are. My romantic heart is sad about it, but I think she's absolutely right that, you know, and his responsibilities will always fall to people other than her as a first son. So, like, Benedict and the Modiste have a much better shot as a couple, even though I don't think they're interested in that, than Anthony and Sienna ever would, because Anthony has pressures that Benedict will never have.
True.
I would like to mention quickly the painter Granville, because he's painting Daphne and Simon's portrait. And there's this wonderful moment where he gets them to try to stand closer together and have Simon put his hand on Daphne's shoulder. And when he does that, Granville looks back up at them and says, the very picture of devotion. I couldn't tell, is he being snarky because he can see that they're acting in that moment, at least at some level, or because he himself has lived a life full of emotional satisfaction being tried through tiny gestures in society that only one person will notice, even if the room is crowded? Does he see something in them that they almost can't recognize themselves? What did you both think?
I think it's the latter.
I was a bit distracted in that moment because I thought the show was going to throw him into the whistle down stakes. I thought they were going to and then that didn't happen. But because they're discussing their plans after that, they were like, we'll go our separate ways, and they're talking about it in front of the painter, and he's listening quite attentively. And I was just it just struck me in that moment. So
that, by the way, like, you know, the way that Simon and Daphne, but really Simon more than anyone else, it's a point that they make over and over and over again in all the different episodes, but they clearly think that servants or like people who are in trade are part of the furniture. Like, they will have the most intimate conversations in front of people, and you're just like, what are you doing? And it's, you know, they genuinely don't think that these are people. You know, it's wild.
I had a small scene I wanted to mention because it struck me as a bit incongruous. This is after Daphne's reached out to Simon and she's read the letters and she's feeling bad and now she wants to sort of make amends. And she invites him over for a family gathering at the Bridgerton's house. And there, Simon is really good with the young Bridgerton kids. Like, he's really nice. He makes a little horse out of paper and he's smiling. And there is nothing about Simon that suggests that he'd be good with kids. I am sorry. There has not been a single moment that suggests that he'd even be comfortable around kids, let alone be, like, really charming.
And then later on, she's like complimenting him about it. And he's like, yes, I've always been good with kids. Doesn't mean that I want them. And I'm just like, I feel like you had this particular conversation in mind, you know, like you just wanted to make that point that people can be good with kids without wanting them. And then you just like shoehorned in this thing.
He seems fine. I mean, he doesn't seem to have any problems.
He doesn't. It's because he's perfect. He's a perfect romantic hero, I guess.
Very suddenly, by the way, like the way the series goes from dark to light in this episode, it's like, I mean, it's done very charmingly, but it's done really fast. Like you can see the clouds literally lift after the scene where she finds the letters and she talks to Lady Danbury, who tells her a little more about, you know, their relationship, and that was it. I mean, things just become light after that.
Yeah, so talking about light, you know, so after they have their ball and it gets rained out and everybody's like, oh my God, so romantic, because the Duke and the Duchess are left by themselves in the middle of the dance floor in the rain. And then everybody just like, you know, leaves them alone, which I thought was like really funny, but also really thoughtful of the ton. And then Daphne makes a little speech and says that, you know, I love you. And even though you're imperfect, you know, it's fine. I love you still. And Simon is almost like he was waiting for her to say that. Like, she's given him some sort of permission to be happy. And he goes up to her and they again make love. And this time, so this is what like really struck me, because all the other times the camera is sort of, you know, whenever they're having sex, the camera is very fleetingly interested in Simon or in his expression. Like, it never really focuses on his face. Yeah, and even when it does, he's usually turned away and like pulling out and, you know, like all that stuff. And then in this one, you know, he is you know, we've seen the camera focus on his face only once before, like full on, and that is when he was being raped, basically, by Daphne in episode 6. And then in this episode, again, the camera focuses on his face, and then it focuses on both their faces. And I thought, like, that was an interesting choice, because finally the two of them were together in a way that they weren't before, because either he was lying or she was, you know, she was raping him. And this one is just the two of them together.
This show, I think, maybe is better at some of the smaller things than it is at some of the bigger things. And it's lovely that they find a way to show consent and mutuality, and like they are choosing to do, to move forward together. It's touching. I loved that the that happens in the same room where Simon was born and where their son is born also, right? Mm-hmm. It's that same bedroom with the blue chinoiserie wallpaper. So that space clearly is important to Simon. And it's a space of vulnerability that that means a lot to him.
Although, can I just say that the childbirth scene made me laugh, because it was like Violet and Daphne are in a completely different scene to Simon. Like, Simon's just there. Like, if I was giving birth in the 19th century and I was like in the room where the previous Duchess literally bled to death after giving birth, like, and if my husband was just like smoochy smoochy to my hand, I would be furious. Like, I would be so angry. I'd be throwing hands at that point. But apart from that, and also, like, Simon just didn't seem to be, like all that worried. I mean, you'd think that he's in that room where his mom died giving birth to him, and his wife is, like, giving birth, and she's clearly having a hard time. And Daphne's tiny, like, teeny tiny, and she's giving birth to this baby, and he's just like, oh, yeah, sure. Like, this is happening. I'm just like, what? What is going on?
Is it unusual for Simon to be in the room at all by Regency standards?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
I do feel like the fact that this show has been renewed for a season 2 and possibly for 8 seasons means that it can take its time to... Because there's a lot of setup in this particular season of the show. And the books themselves cover a period of about 20 years, if I'm not mistaken. Oh, wow. Yeah. Or 15? Like, I'm not sure. Like, 15 or 20 years, something like that. And so this is before Waterloo. And then I think it extends into the 1820s, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. Mm-hmm. The late 1820s. So about 15 years. And like, that's a significant period of time. And so a lot of the people that we see in this episode are really young. And especially people like Colin and Penn. And I'm really interested to see how those people are going to grow and what that arc is going to be. This series has a very light touch when it comes to deeper issues, but also it insists on touching upon those issues.
Yeah.
And I really don't understand that motivation. Like, it seems to be a show that is very comfortable in a very particular space where, you know, it's very open about the fact that it's a romance and that it's, you know, fluffy and light and full of air and pretty people. But on the same time, it seems to want to address the fact that it exists within a certain context that is the very opposite. And I don't think they know exactly how to deal with that as yet. And my hope is that maybe in the second season, they'll be able to do a better job of it. But I'm just going to keep my fingers crossed.
I agree. Uday, any overarching thoughts about the whole series you'd like to share? Any favorite characters? Any impressions of what you think the show did particularly well?
Favorite character, I think, has been Antony, which which I'm finding a little difficult to defend, because he's just like one terrible decision after the other, and he's just like such a baby. But he's great. I thought the actor is great, and his sideburns are telling their own story, which is always fun. And he's actually really funny. Like especially in the family scenes, instead of being the kind of forbidding elder English upper class brother, he's like he manages to do it in a slightly subtler sort of harried way, and I found his performance quite fun. So I enjoyed Anthony basically being at the same place emotionally as he was right at the start after everyone else has found some kind of growth.
I love that little moment in this episode where Benedict and Eloise are on the couch eating chocolates and kind of having a bit of a confidential moment. Then Anthony pops down with them and grabs a chocolate. And he's like, Benedict, it's fine if you're with Genevieve. If she makes you happy, great. And he grabs another chocolate and walks off. And Eloise and Benedict look at each other. And Benedict goes, what's in that chocolate? That's the kind of shorthand that you can get away with your family that is not how you talk to people outside your family.
No, the show really did sell me on the Bridgertons as a family. I didn't know how that would be in the first episode because there's just so many characters that suddenly turn up. But they really do, over the episodes, the family scenes are the ones that like really, I thought those were really nicely done.
Well, I'm not going to ask Amrita about her overall thoughts of the whole series because we have one more episode of this podcast coming, a ninth episode where we will bring on yet another guest to talk about the series overall and some of these big questions about what it does, how it works, and some of the people who are in it. So with that, let's wrap up episode 8. Uday, where can people find you and your work online?
So they can find me on Twitter at Uday, that's Y-O-O-D-A-Y, and I post most of my pieces out there. I write for a newspaper called Mint Lounge, mostly about film.
Amrita, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at AmritaIQ or on YouTube at AmritaByTheBook. You can also find me on Khandan, a Bollywood podcast that I co-host.
And I am Beth Loves Bolly on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you soon for episode 9.